Judge Connolly, Judge Ross, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you and good morning. Our second case is Nelson versus Commercia Bank et al. As all parties are aware, the appellant and respondent will each have 15 minutes and then respondent will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So for counsel for the appellant, when you're ready, could you just identify yourself in a loud, clear voice and then the time will start.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Aaron Thome, and I represent the appellant, Sharon Nelson. Sharon Nelson is the half-sister of recording artist Prince Rogers Nelson, who passed away April 21st, 2016. Nelson is one of six heirs of Prince's estate. She is 79 years old. In February of 2019, Nelson, proceeding pro se, brought a complaint against Comerica Bank, which is the personal representative of Prince's estate. Nelson alleged breach of fiduciary duty, fraud, civil assault, and civil conspiracy. Nelson brought that claim because the district court in the probate proceeding has put in place procedures that prevent Nelson from presenting and pursuing claims against Comerica. Comerica moved to dismiss Nelson's complaint under Rule 12, and the district court granted that motion. The district court dismissed the breach of fiduciary duty claim on res judicata grounds. And as the court knows, res judicata has four prongs or four elements. And two of those elements were not satisfied here. The requirement that there be full and fair opportunity to litigate the prior claim, and the requirement that there be identicality between the prior claim and the present claim. Now, as a backdrop here, the court knows res judicata is not to be rigidly applied. And both this court and the Supreme Court have made clear that res judicata is to only be applied in light of the particular facts of a specific case. Here in the probate proceeding, we have one of the most unique cases probably this court has ever seen. And it is an extremely unusual case in which it's very difficult. And in fact, Ms. Nelson has been barred from raising the claims that she now attempts to bring against Comerica.
It's agreed, is it not, Mr. Thome, that this is a supervised administration and that the actions of Comerica have not included any action that was either prohibited by or not approved by the probate court?
Well, it is a supervised administration, Your Honor, that's true. And if you'll notice, we've limited this appeal with respect to the breach of fiduciary duty claim to actions that we believe have not been addressed by the court in the probate proceeding. And we made very clear in the briefing, we pointed out the specific allegations, and then we looked at the district court saying, here's where that was addressed. And we pointed and we explained why that was not addressed in the manner that the district court said that it was. But looking at the full and fair litigation requirement, the first reason why there was no full and fair opportunity to litigate for Nelson is she has not been provided the opportunity to take discovery or to do fact finding. District court acknowledged that in the dismissal order, said Nelson has not been able to take discovery or conduct fact finding. District court didn't say anything about that, didn't say, well, that's a reason why she didn't have an opportunity to fully and fairly litigate, nor did the district court say that she has had that opportunity. The district court just simply said there's been no discovery or fact finding on these issues, period. And throughout the probate proceeding, Nelson has said to the district court, I want the opportunity to take discovery on this fiduciary misconduct. And she's never been given that opportunity.
Isn't the proper place for that in the probate proceeding?
She's been denied it in the probate proceeding. She's been denied that opportunity. She's made the request. It's been denied.
There are other heirs here, correct? Were there four others? Am I recalling that correctly?
There are six total heirs.
Five others. What's to prevent the other five from starting their own independent actions against the fiduciary and having multiple district court lawsuits outside the probate proceedings, which are supervised?
Anyone with standing can raise a claim for breach of fiduciary duty. Now, in the probate proceeding, to the extent that Ms. Nelson has attempted to bring these, she has been joined by other heirs. In fact, most recently, in a petition that was filed in 2019 by all of the heirs requesting that Comerica be removed, they were all unified. And going back to the full...
And Comerica was not removed, correct?
The district court did not remove Comerica. What the district court did is point back to a decision that the district court made in December of 2017 and said, these sound a lot like the issues that you were raising in December of 2017. But the problem with that is that a lot changed between December of 2017 and 2019. And the fact that the district court leaps all the way back to 2017 and says, based on an order that I entered before these breaches occurred, you can't raise any breaches. The district court is essentially saying, I've given carte blanche approval to Comerica in 2017 to commit fiduciary breaches, and those can't be challenged. That's not how res judicata applies. Minnesota law is to the contrary. And we've targeted three specific breaches that are new and different from issues that have ever been addressed by the district court. And the first is this agreement to a 14-year tax payoff plan by Comerica. They've informed Nelson and the other heirs that they've done this. Nelson has asked, why? Why have you agreed to such an extended payoff plan? Comerica is taking hundreds of thousands of dollars from the estate every month. There has not and will not be any payout to the heirs, any distribution, until this estate closes. There is a conflict. Comerica has a strong interest in keeping this estate open. And the fact that they can't answer Nelson's question and say, what's your reason? Do you have alternatives? No, they won't say. That's a breach of fiduciary duty. Relatedly, Comerica has failed to correspond and communicate in a timely manner with the IRS. That too is a breach of fiduciary duty. It's caused the estate unnecessary expenses. She's alleged it. Properly pled, that's a breach of fiduciary duty. And third, Comerica has misused and failed to preserve the assets of the estate. As Nelson has alleged, Comerica removed cassette tapes, original Prince recordings that cannot be replaced from the vault in Paisley Park, and they took them to Iron Mountain Storage in California. For that, they did have approval of the district court. That's true. But what they didn't have approval to do is remove those cassette tapes from the vault, from Iron Mountain, and store those cassette tapes at Comerica Bank and in an individual's home. And that individual has since listened to those, allowed others to listen to those unique, one-of-a-kind recordings, devaluing the assets of the estate. That's another breach of fiduciary duty.
Could that be brought to the probate court's attention for possible removal or other sanction of the personal representative or of the bank?
Most recently, what the district court said in an April 2019 order, the district court said any concerns with Comerica's actions or authority brought by the heirs must be resolved through open communication, and failing open communication, they shall be referred to mediation. They shall be referred to mediation.
Have you referred those questions to mediation?
There's no judicial recourse here. To go to mediation and say, okay, we'd like to resolve this issue, Comerica will say, okay, well, what are you going to do to us if we don't agree? Are you going to come after us in the probate proceeding? Because the district court has said, I'm unwilling to entertain these objections. That's what Nelson has received from the district court in the probate proceeding.
That sounds like a no.
I agree, Your Honor. The answer is no at this point. The district court has said, you can't bring these objections to me.
No, my question was, have you attempted to mediate these disputes? And then your answer sounded like a no.
I can't speak to everything that's been attempted with respect to each issue in the complicated probate proceeding. But I do know that there has been no resolution to this issue. So to the extent that, and I know questions have been asked of Comerica. So if that constitutes an attempt at mediation, asking Nelson, what's happening with these recordings, that has been attempted. But beyond that, it doesn't know what to do other than pursue this claim here in the civil context.
Mr. Thome, I wanted to shift for just a few moments to the civil assault claim. You know, I would concede that, you know, the Rule 12 standard review, you cannot dismiss a case for, you know, judicial efficiency. So clearly there are problems with the order. But my question is, you know, what if, do you agree that mere words alone do not constitute a civil assault?
I do agree with that, Your Honor. That's the law. Mere words are not assault, but when you have the ability and you take actions to threaten someone and cause them to imminently fear or to fear imminent harmful bodily contact, that is assault. And here in paragraph 40 of the complaint, it's alleged that one of the heirs, plaintiff's sister Noreen, was seated directly next to plaintiff during the incident at the meeting. Upon seeing Bruce march across the room and approach plaintiff so aggressively, Noreen stopped her conversation with another heir, Tyka, and fearing an attack, stood in order to defend her sister. Now, this is an observer. This is objective fear, objectively frightening conduct, causing another observer to stand up and try to intervene and avoid the harmful bodily conduct that Nelson anticipated. And in paragraph 134, Nelson alleges that defendant Bruce's actions caused plaintiff to reasonably expect to be imminently harmed. Plaintiff froze in place during the incident because she expected she was about to be hit. That's civil assault.
So are you saying, and you know, I guess maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but are you saying if for the purposes of Rule 12, you know, a factual question is presented? Is that the bottom line?
That's at least fair to say, Your Honor. This certainly meets the Rule 12 standard, yes. And to speak to the fraud claim, both the District Court and Comerica notably avoid the allegation that we've really put front and center in this appeal. And during these initial interviews, which nobody disputes that these interviews happened and when they happened or who was involved, it was Acock and Bruce making representations to the heirs to obtain their endorsement of Comerica. And they specifically told the heirs that you will be involved in the decision-making process for this estate. The heirs, and Nelson in particular, would not have given Comerica endorsement had Comerica told the truth at that time. And this was a present intention. They knew at the time they made these representations that they were not going to give a voice or any decision-making ability to these heirs. And that's why we see today attempts by the heirs to remove Comerica in a joint and unified fashion. Now, this fraud claim has never been heard below. It's never been considered. And like the breach of fiduciary duty claim, the district court has made clear that the district court is not going to entertain it. The only place that Nelson can do this is here in this action. And that fraud claim is properly pled. A heightened pleading standard is met. And that claim should not have been dismissed either. Unless your honors have other questions, I'll conclude at this point and save the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Looks like Judge Ross is trying to speak.
Judge Ross is trying to speak, but he apparently doesn't know what a mute button looks like. Okay, I think I'm audible now. I just want to be clear on the complaint. Your position is the complaint doesn't have to allege any actual conduct of a physical threat.
I wouldn't say that, Your Honor. I think a physical threat is alleged. Marching up to someone and causing them to expect to be hit, that's physical.
Well, if you're pointing to the subjective impression of the person who feels threatened, but doesn't the complaint have to allege something that would demonstrate objectively that there is some act of a threat or a statement of a threat?
It does have to be objectively reasonable, Your Honor. And that's why I think it's worth noting that a third party here perceived a threat enough to stand up and try to intervene. So it is objective. I agree with you. It can't just be based on subjective intent of the victim. But here, there are reasons, and it is alleged, it is at the very least alleged, that this is an objectively reasonable perception of imminent harmful bodily conduct.
In all fairness to, I'm looking at your complaint. It doesn't say, all it says is that the witness stopped her conversation.
And still,
it doesn't say she sort of got in between the two parties to break up the fight. Is that correct?
Yeah, it says stood in order to defend her sister.
Your view is it doesn't have to be clear that it was to defend her from a physical attack. It's, you don't have to allege that. Defend can mean a lot of things. It could be just intervene in a verbal altercation that doesn't have any objective threat involved.
But it is objective physical threat here, Your Honor, because it says she saw Bruce march across the room and approach plaintiff so aggressively. It was in response to the aggressive nature in which Bruce approached Nelson. So it absolutely is physical. I do agree with Your Honor. It has to be physical. It does. But it is here.
Thank you.
We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. And if one of you could give me a thumbs up just to make sure you can hear what I'm saying right now. Okay. All three. I'll take
three.
May it please the court. My name is Joe Cassiope. I'm with Fredrickson and Byron. We represent the respondents, Comerica Bank and Trust N.A., Angela Acock, and Andrea Bruce. The appellant, Ms. Nelson, brought her complaint seeking $10 billion in damages solely in an attempt to harass respondents out of frustration, out of the fact that she has tried time and time again to attempt to force the removal of Comerica as personal representative and has repeatedly lost those attempts in the probate proceeding and has chosen not to appeal. Ms. Nelson's complaint asserted more than a dozen separate factual bases to support her alleged claims, the majority of which she has conceded by not attempting to defend them on appeal, did not have a basis in fact or law. All of the remaining claims fail either based on the doctrines of res judicata or because Ms. Nelson failed to state an adequate claim under Minnesota law.
The district does Comerica, if I could just ask a question, Mr. Cassiope, does Comerica agree that, for example, the claim of misused estate assets being moved to California to a place that Ms. Nelson contends is inappropriate and maybe damaging the value of those recordings, does Comerica agree that that issue, to the extent that it hasn't been addressed by the probate court, could still be resolved by the probate court?
Absolutely not, because it has, well, I agree that if it hadn't been resolved by the probate court, it could be, I should listen to the end of your question before answering. It could be resolved by the probate court, but that specific allegation, and in fact, all of the three examples provided by counsel were in fact addressed by the probate court in its various orders, either denying petitions to remove Comerica or approving Comerica's interim accountings. And under well-established Minnesota law, those are final binding orders to which res judicata applies. But absolutely.
But just a minute. They're not binding in this sense. Comerica could still be removed. Could Comerica not?
Comerica could still be removed if the petitioners came forward with new allegations that had not yet been raised and had not yet been approved. Absolutely. But Comerica has, or Ms. Nelson has previously addressed, raised, and sought relief based on these exact same allegations that Ms. Nelson is attempting to raise on appeal. I want to start as a threshold matter and just address it briefly, our motion to strike and the waiver argument. And this is born out of the fact that Ms. Nelson chose not to timely respond to the motions, requested additional time, chose not to meet that deadline. And then when she did file her opposition, she chose not to serve it on respondents, which made it impossible for respondents to move to strike the papers, and did not allow respondents to file a reply, which the district court had provided for. And in light of that, the proper remedy here really should be the striking of those documents from the record on appeal. And it is our position that Ms. Nelson has waived all arguments, but at a minimum, Ms. Nelson should be barred from criticizing the district court for allegedly failing to address arguments that Ms. Nelson either did not raise below, or which the district court did not fully analyze because there wasn't a full record, because we weren't allowed to reply. And I think the best example of that is the civil assault claim. We agree that really the lens through which the court should be reviewing the civil assault claim is whether Ms. Nelson asserted a viable claim under Minnesota law, whether an adequate claim has been pled, and it absolutely has not been. And I have to say, as an initial matter, the allegation is blatantly, patently false, and it's being brought purely for harassment purposes.
But of course, that's not an argument in Rule 12 land, right?
Of course, and I just state that for the record, because obviously this was extremely offensive to my client, but we accept the allegations and the pleading as true. There are three separate stories that Ms. Nelson has told about this incident in her complaint. The first of which is Exhibit C to her complaint, which is the contemporaneous version. And then the second and third are in the body of the complaint. But I'll use the one that Ms. Nelson referred to in her brief, which is, she says, on or about February 28th, 2017, at the meeting, defendant Bruce stood up, walked quickly around the conference table toward the plaintiff, and came to a stop, placing her own face less than 6 inches in front of plaintiff's face. Defendant Bruce proceeded to yell in plaintiff's face that she would have no voice or influence on decisions and that there would be no distributions. That does not state a civil assault claim under Minnesota law, because there are two fundamental elements to such a claim. First, there needs to be an unlawful threat of bodily harm. And second, there needs to be the present ability to effectuate the threat. There's no allegation that...
Can I take you to Dahlin?
Yes, sir.
Dahlin does lay that out, but it also characterizes the necessary threat as a display of force causing reasonable apprehension of bodily harm. And it seems as if the district court focused on the reasonableness of the apprehension, which sounds to me like a question that needs more facts, at least some discovery to determine the reasonableness and not to be disposed of in a motion to dismiss. Can you address that concern?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree with that point for this reason.
With the characterization of the law, or the characterization of what the district court, how the district court decided?
With the proposition that no threat is necessary under Dahlin, because the elements come directly from Dahlin. And so I would agree with you if Ms. Nelson had pled that Ms. Bruce had raised a fist or had taken some overaction other than walking quickly towards her and yelling at her about distributions, I would agree it would be a closer case, but we don't.
To be clear, then, I just want to be clear on what you're saying. So you agree that a physical act without words, including, it could be a gesture, raising a hand, but you're saying abruptly charging towards someone can't put someone in a reasonable apprehension of imminent harm, but raising a hand does?
The allegation that is pled, that Ms. Bruce walked quickly around the conference table, does not make a threat. That is her exact, that's her exact words, Your Honor. I would agree, though.
It was walked quickly. I'm sorry, forgive me, but just to be clear, I thought it was walked quickly around the conference table and got with 6 inches nose to nose. That certainly gives a different flavor than just walking around a table. Can that itself be threatening?
Could that be a threat of bodily harm under as pled? No. As pled, no. Could you have pled it differently, where she pled it that she rose a fist or appeared ready to strike? Ms. Nelson could have pled that she didn't. I want to move to res judicata.
Before you do that, you have still pending, if we were to reverse the district court's without prejudice dismissal of the civil assault claim. I understand the record to be that there's an as yet unresolved motion to consolidate that action should it survive the Rule 12 analysis with the probate proceeding. Am I right on that?
That's correct. We have asked that to the extent that any claims survive, that they all be consolidated into the probate hearing, which is a supervised proceeding, and be deemed a petition or a motion for a surcharge, which is the proper way to bring claims against a personal representative to the extent that those claims have not already been dealt with.
Would it be true that same proceeding would be appropriate as to any new claims raised in this complaint that have not previously been adjudicated in the supervised administration?
Absolutely, and not only could it be, but it is the proper forum under which it should be.
So your argument really is that res judicata ought to bar all of the claims against the fiduciary for fraud and other claims, but that it, to the extent that res judicata does not bar them, the probate code envisions that those would be handled in the probate proceeding under the supervision of the probate court.
That's correct. And Ms. Nelson has cited statute section 524.3-1005 in response to that. But that statute does not state what Ms. Nelson represents it states. What that statute deals with is situations where claims arise against a personal representative after the closing of the estate. And the key aspect of that that counsel and Ms. Nelson ignore is that it only deals with claims that were not previously barred by adjudication. And so, yes, that's the proper way. I do want to very briefly deal with the res judicata elements. Ms. Nelson challenges only two elements, the new or continuing claim element and the full and fair opportunity element. On the new and continuing claim element, we've addressed that on our brief, but I want to talk about the three allegations mentioned by counsel. First, the 14-year payoff plan allegation. I'd refer the court to paragraph 52 of Ms. Nelson's October 27th, 2017 petition, where she raised that identical allegation in support of her petition to remove Comerica, and that petition was denied. With respect to the misused assets, Ms. Nelson waived that argument below in her opposition. So even if the court does not strike her, all of her arguments on appeal, on page 8 of her opposition to Comerica's motion to dismiss, she conceded that all allegations related to the assets previously held at the vault were dealt with in the court's petition to remove Comerica. It's on page 8 of her opposition.
The 2019 petition.
The 2017 petition.
17 petition, okay.
2017 petition. And I'd refer the court to page 8. And I'll also say that since then, Comerica has sought and obtained approval of its account for the time period dealt with by Ms. Nelson's petition here. So Comerica, on March 10th of 2020, Comerica obtained an order approving its accounting for the time period of February 2018 through January 2019. So even if there were matters that were not barred when Ms. Nelson brought this petition, which was in February of 2019. So it was all based upon conduct that occurred prior to this period. They are now barred and she cannot pursue them. And she did not object to that accounting.
Remind me, if you would, Mr. Cassiope, about the frequency with which the representative is obligated to do those periodic accountings.
The personal representative files an accounting on an annual basis, but in addition to that, and why Ms. Nelson's claims regarding the personal representative's compensation and fees cannot escape res judicata is that every 4 months, Comerica files a substantial fee application detailing all of its activities and the compensation for it and its agents. And those are approved by the court every 4 months.
And have been approved?
They have all been approved across the board for the last 3 years, with one exception. Ms. Nelson objected to one, and the attorney's fees were reduced by about $6,000 based upon that objection. But with that exception, the court has approved all of Comerica's fees and the fees of its agents, and Ms. Nelson has never appealed from that. I also want to very briefly deal with why the fraud claim is barred by res judicata. And that is because Ms. Nelson raised the identical claim in support of her petition to remove Comerica. If you go to page 8 of Ms. Nelson's November 17th, 2017 reply in support of her removal petition, she asked the probate court to remove Comerica for fraudulent misrepresentation based upon the identical allegations she's now seeking to sue Comerica for. And so that is absolutely barred by res judicata, and it's also barred for failure to state the claim with particularity for the reasons set forth in our brief. I see I'm out of time, so I ask that the court affirm the district court order on the motion to dismiss and for sanctions, and to the extent that there are any remaining claims, that those be consolidated into the probate proceeding where they can be dealt with in the nature of a petition for surcharge. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Thom, you'll have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. Comerica claims over and over again that Nelson raised this issue. Nelson raised that issue. She tried. Nelson has tried. She's tried to raise issues. Nelson has asked for discovery. Nelson has asked Comerica for information and documents. They won't give anything to her unless they choose in their discretion that they want to hand it over to her. She has never had an opportunity to pursue what Comerica claims that she has raised below. That makes res judicata inapplicable. And Comerica also argues everything's been addressed by the probate court. There's nothing new here. Well, that's simply not true. If you look at the briefing here, look at the parts of the complaint that the district court said, I've addressed this, and then look at the portions of the probate record that the district court points to, and it will be clear. These issues have never been addressed. The taking of the cassette recordings out of the court-approved storage facility in Iron Mountain, California, that has never been addressed. And the final point, Your Honor asked, well, can Comerica still be removed? Well, in light of the probate court's most recent directive, all concerns about Comerica, its authority, and its actions, if they are not resolved by open communication, shall be referred to mediation. With nothing more behind that.
Well, but you haven't mediated, right?
Well, again, Your Honor, I believe that this issue has been, the communications that the judge has directed occur have been attempted by Ms. Nelson.
I understand that's her claim, and I at this point, I don't have any reason to doubt that. But then you're supposed to, then the way I understand the probate judge's order is you're supposed to try and mediate the disputes, and I would presume, without saying so, that if the parties don't agree, then you go back to the probate court.
Look what happened when Ms. Nelson exercised her statutory rights to petition, along with two other heirs, for the removal of Comerica in October of 2017. The district court denied that and went further. Said, I'm going to sanction you under Rule 11 for bringing that petition, for exercising your statutory right. And the only reason that those sanctions weren't awarded in that first instance of her exercising her statutory right is because Comerica spent so much money responding to that petition that the judge said, I can't grant that. She fears having the same thing happen again. There is a viable threat that if she exercises her right to petition for Comerica's removal, she will be subject to sanctions merely for exercising that right. And I disagree with opposing counsel's characterization of Minnesota statute 524.3-1005. That statute specifically says it speaks to claims that have arisen during the proceeding. And it says, unless otherwise barred by adjudication, they must be brought within 6 months of the closing of the estate. These are not after arising claims. So Nelson has pursued a separate proceeding, and she has a right to do so. She's stated valid claims. This is her opportunity to take discovery and pursue these claims, and the court should reverse the dismissal for that reason. Unless your honors have any other questions, I'll conclude there. Thank you.
I think we do not. So the matter is submitted. I thank counsel for participating by WebEx and also for the quality of their briefs. Please stay safe. We are now adjourned.
Thank you, Your Honors.